Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am Pat Rulo, and today I have a writer at Heart and Soul Theatre Company. Hailing from Dublin, Ireland, he is Hugh Murphy. And today he's got quite a bit to talk about, a couple of books that he's written, and a very serious message. So I'm going to just dig right in. Welcome to the network, Hugh.
Yeah, hello, and thanks very much for having me on. No, it's really about a book that I published there with an American company just before Christmas called Memories and Observations, which I have been sentenced or censored with in Ireland. Basically, I was sacked by my union and the employers 50 years ago. And that led to me writing this book and the previous one, which has all the documentation about the second in it. This was the first time anywhere in the world that a trade union joined with employers to persecute and sack their own members. Now, this is diabolical, but to put a legal framework around what they were doing, they put everything in writing, which I have on the way of now. And it's diabolical. It said the button was Belfast and Irish Trans, Belfast and Federation of Employers and Irish Transport and General Workers Union Joint Disciplinary Committee. Now, this is diabolical, you know, for a union, especially the union that fought the Free Ireland, led by James Connolly, who led the union, the Dublin branch of the union and the GPO to fight the British, which made part of Ireland free. So, anyway, from then, I was a Belfast docker, and the union always was very hard on the dockers, you know, mostly because, I didn't understand at the time, but because it was a Dublin-based union, and it was in the north of Ireland, which was still belongs to England, which still belonged to England. So, there was no militancy. The union had to accept whatever the employers wanted to give them, basically, and that was it. So, but in the 19, the union always fined the dockers money. You know, basic fine was £10. And when in 1970, from about 1970 on, they had let the union the members know that any docker not in the union before 1968 was getting put out, was getting expelled. So all the young dockers from 1968 were, when decolonization happened in 1972, they were put away from the docks. Now, the union and the employers done that. And there hadn't been a word about this joint disciplinary committee when the dockers accepted decolonization. So what happened then was anyone that questioned anything that were brought up before this court, that was essentially a union and employers court, and it sacked anyone who wouldn't do what they want. Now, I refused to work at asbestos. So I was brought up before this union. You know, I wouldn't go. They kept sending me letters to come to the Joint Disciplinary Committee, they called it. So I refused to go. I said, what am I doing? I'm not. Why should I go up there and be tried for something which is a human right for me not to work at asbestos? But nay, so what happened then? They sacked me and wouldn't employ me. But so the dockers went on strike again, and they were on strike for 3 days. and then the employers come up with a solution that I could appeal the sentence. So all the dockers there, well, you can appeal the sentence, and if you're still sacked, then we'll go on strike again. So I didn't. I said, look, if you agree to that, you're agreeing that they can sack me. My union employers can't sack me. First of all, because the union don't employ me. Anyway, so the men wanting back to work, they earn money, you know. He said, look, appeal to you. And yeah. So, all right, so I put the appeal in, and about 3 weeks later, I was up before, oh, had to go to the Stella Morris. That's where that was the Seaman's Hospital, where the court sat. So when I was in, and the questioner, there was three union men, and actually, I forgot about that. The chairman of the union, Jim Lawson, he turned traitor. He negotiated the decastalization scheme, then left the union and joined the employers. And I said, at the time, I said, wait a minute, an employer organized this and set up this. Why should we agree with that? But anyway, lo and behold, the dockers accepted it. Anyway, so we went to the court, the Joint Disciplinary Committee, and this guy, Jim Mawson, he hung around in the background, and there was two members of the union committee and two employers there. So they wanted, it was like a court, a prosecutor, Austin, and some more guy prosecuting. You know, why would you do it? I says, well, man, why should I work at asbestos? When you know and I know it can kill you. You know, so the hemmed and hawed and all that there. So eventually I was sacked. You know, I was at the said, you're sacked. You know, collect your insurance cards and all the rest. So I went, that was about 4 o'clock, you know, 5 o'clock. So everybody was finishing work. So I left it the next morning and I went back down into the pen. It was a big shed that was nicknamed after a cow pen where we were schooled. I was employed. That's how you got employed. You all stood around a foreman and he picked who you wanted. So I went in and I said, right now I've been sacked. This is it. You know. So half the men went to work and half, less than half, supported me. But unbeknownst to me at the time, leading up to this court, the union had been running behind my back and persuading everybody that I was a communist, you know, and spreading rumors about what communism, well, I don't know whether it was true or not, but what communism did on the nuns in Africa, how they butchered them raped them and butchered them and all that. So they convinced the men and went to strike for 3 days and then went back to work. So I threw the head up and walked away, and that was it. I wouldn't go back near the docks. Not that, you know. So anyway, from then on, I started writing plays, and I had written a play about the docks, and then, but I met a guy, this guy Martin Lynch. He was one of the dockers, young dockers that was sacked under the 1968 rule. He was working on his DOS card. They allowed that, you know. But because we wrote and printed the docker's voice, which highlighted what the union was doing on the dockers. So while they couldn't sack me under the casual system, they rescinded Lynch's right to work on his DOS card. And they said it had nothing to do with us writing the docker's voice. So once he was gone, that was that day, had no access. He was in a couple of community schemes who printed the paper for us. So anyway, once he was gone, you know, for 2 weeks, there was no paper. Then this guy from the Young Socialist, John McGee, he approached me with a young dogger who was getting put out. And he said he would print the paper. So along with all the young Dockers and myself, we kept gathering stories and putting them in the Docker's Voice. And then once decolonization came, they were put away from the docks, and I was left totally on my own there. And then they sacked me anyway. So anyway, to cut a long story short, after I was sacked, I started to write. And I wrote a play, the outline of a play about the docks. But one of the young Dockers, one of the guys who had helped, had started the Dockers Voice with me, Martin Lynch, he had written a play about the docks called The Dockers. And I thought, that's great, you know, and told him about the Union Employers Court and all, expecting him to put it into his play, even just a bit to bring it up to date. And no, but, well, he said he would, but he didn't. So when the play went on, the Dockers went to see it, no, but I waited for a while before going, because I didn't want to look them in the eye, any of the ones that wouldn't go on strike for me. So when I went to see the play, it was about the docks 20 years before. Nothing about the court, the Union Employers Court, or nothing like that. So when I said, then why didn't you put that in? And I told him about me writing the play. He says, well, that'll be play number two, you know, which never materialized. So a couple of years later, I met him again, and he had formed a play company of his own to stage his own plays. And he said, look, what's this play you've got, you know? And I thought, he says, no, and the other play that he had heard about. And I said, oh, Justice. And he says, yeah. So he read, him and Joe Devlin, who directed it, read the play and thought it was brilliant. They wanted to do it. So they put it on for 2 weeks and it went down great. So with the success of my play, Justice, he applied to the Arts Council for funding, and they came on board and they gave a lot of funding. And so we toured 3 weeks in Northern Ireland, and then a week in the Belfast Festival, and then we took it to the Dublin Festival. I was invited into the Dublin Festival, and then to Toronto and Glasgow. So everything went well, very well, but I never got any money out of it. So once the funding was in place and all, you know, and I wasn't worried about funding, you know, at the start. Anyway, at the start, there was no money to pay the actors. And I had said any money was being equally divided. And I said, no, I don't want none. Give my share to the actors. So after, when funding was secured and all the rest, and everybody was getting equity rates, so I said, what about me? And Lynn said, oh, but you said you didn't want. I said, well, I was the one that was no money. Anyway, to cut a long story short, without me not getting funding and a whole lot of other things, everyone was complaining about the name of the company Lynch had was Point Fields. So we went with that because he had all the documentation on it. So there was a whole lot of big stink at the time. After my play, there was nothing for about 2 years, and he was getting Arts Council funded. And there was a big stink about it. So I ended up, I resigned from, I had no say in running the company. Oh, sorry, I forgot to say, I was the director of the company, along with Joe Devlin and Lynch and Joe Woods and Owen McCafferty. So, we're always thinking on, and me having no say, I resigned, but not realizing that two other directors had resigned before me, which left Lynch and Joe Devlin on their own. And they couldn't get funding and all the rest. And eventually the Arts Council closed them down. So After that, I continued writing and came down. I got invited to a writer centre by the Arts Council in Anna McCarrick. It's a big director's house in County Monaghan. I think it is Cavan or Monaghan, not sure, I can't remember. And that's a lovely big place, you know, for 2 weeks. And I met a load of directors and writers from Dublin and all. And by this time, I had finished a Daft play. And I called it the Judas Goat after the Union chairman who sold out. So, and, you know, I read a bit of it to them, and they all thought it was brilliant. Now, come, they'll be delighted to put that on in Dublin and all. So I moved down to Dublin, and but when I tried to get the play on, I was blanked everywhere. No one wanted to know it, you know. So I didn't realise the power that the union still had down here, and still had. You know, and this was in 1990, and I had been sacked, you know, in, what, 74. So I thought, you know, any part of the union had would have disappeared now, but not so. So from then on, I've been writing a lot. I wrote a lot of plays on a stage too, and I couldn't get a play on anywhere. And the director of, you know, the project theater, what's his name? Kian O'Brien. Yeah. I wanted him to put on a play of mine, not about Daft Sterling. I had decided I'd come up against that many brick walls because of Judas Goat. I've set that aside and wrote several other plays. And one play was an old woman production called Love Never Dies. And I thought, you know, he would definitely do it. No. He said, we are a receiving house, and we only receive, we don't state this, which was nonsense, because I've been talking to people who had plays on. So I said, fair enough, man, how much do you charge? What's your rate, your going rate, to hire your theatre? And he wouldn't give me a price. You know, I said, well, man, that price range. So after that, I could only contact him by email. He would never come to the phone. Anytime I would go down to the theatre, couldn't get seen him. He wasn't there, or he was away, or whatever. So that basically was how things went. And then I formed a wee theatre company and called Heart and Soul Theatre Company. We're a couple of good people, you know. So we staged two plays. You know, one was called Daddy, about the after effects of child abuse. And the other was five women. And the other was a two-hander on about an alcoholic who is trying to sort his life out. You know, talking to his delusion, which is, you know, the female character in the play, you know. So, and they went down great, you know. But no one from the theatre world would review them, especially the Irish Times theatre critic. Anyway, it'll come down a minute. Anyway, he wouldn't review the play, but he put on a thing on Fintan O'Toole, that's his name. He put a thing up. I asked him on Twitter, why wouldn't you review the other play? Why will you not review this one? And he wouldn't answer me. But he put my what I asked him and his reply up on his website on Twitter, which was basically mocking me for asking him why he wouldn't review it. And actually, this guy, he spends half a year lecturing in a university in the States. You know, and he's very proud of his working class roots. You know, his blue collar, you know, as he calls it, or as you call it out there. And, but he would not review my play. And no newspaper in Ireland will. And they all know about it. They know about the corruption of the union and the union and the employer's second union members. And none of them will do anything about it. You know, I've written to them all, you know, even the talk shows, you know, Joe Duffy and, you know, several others. Joe Duffy, he has a great program called Talk to Joe, but Joe won't talk to me. And actually, I left a copy of the other book, The Judas Goat, and the Hand, where all the documentation from the union, all the letters from the union, and the letters from the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, and so on, and are in the book. Actually, it's on, they're on www.SIP2PresidentJackOConnorExposed.com. He was union president then, who tried to buy me off. He kept setting up meetings for me to go and talk to him. It was the finance director, I can't remember his name. And I was dealing with the finance director. It was him who was setting up all these meetings, but it wasn't Jack O'Connor. So I took that as a subtle message, you know, from if the finance director was wanting to negotiate with me and wanting to meet me. Obviously, it was a ruse, and what they were going to do was buy me off. So I refused to go to any of the meetings. And all the meetings, they set up with six meetings, and they're all on that website, you know. So that led to... And to me, writing this memoir, and it deals with a lot more, that's bringing me up to the memoir. And it starts off with my childhood and, you know, the terrible childhood I had. And I won't go into that. You can read, anybody can read it in the book. It's too much, don't want to talk about that, but you can read about it. And going to school and then going to the docks and leading up the whole thing. It basically, what happened then after leaving the docks, right, I drove a black taxi on the Falls Road. And if anybody that was ever in Belfast knows about the black taxis. The black taxi was basically, and is still going, a bus service where you paid a bus fare, you crammed in as many people as you wanted, and you charged them a bus fare. So, this is during the Troubles. So, the British Army, every day, would block the Falls Road. You know, them big concrete bollards, and they would swing out these gates and chain them shut, which meant you couldn't get a living. You couldn't earn a living to drive up down the Falls Road once they blocked the road, because then you had to use the side streets, and it was pandemonium every day. So I got a hammer and I just smashed the lap, you know, and opened the gate and drove through. So because of me doing that, what happened then was they planted bullets in my taxi, and I got arrested, and, you know, and then I got bailed, and then I got a trial. And I was kept telling the sister-in-law, says, look, you better plead guilty here. This judge is an ex-British soldier. And I said, I don't care if he's an ex-Pope or Roman, that's pleading guilty, something they didn't do, you know. And it was my wife, she said, Look, there was no way I was going to do it anyway, she said, but, I mean, if you plead guilty to that, and they do it again, what are you going to say? I was innocent the first time as well, so, but I wasn't going to do it anyway, and didn't. So, during the trial, the soldiers were swearing my life away, you know, and then, at lunchtime, when just before lunchtime, they broke for lunch anyway, and the judge all raised, judge left the courtroom, and my barrister had been ripping lumps out of the soldier, because he had, shortly after the planted the bullets, the police interrogated them, and he told what happened, you know, what he said happened, that he found a bag and set it on the driving seat, you know, and emptied out the contents. But when it came to the trial, he said he didn't do it. The major done it. So they couldn't even decide who, not only could they not decide who planted them, they couldn't decide who found them. So I'm standing in the dock and the soldiers walking past, and the prosecutor, and Mr. Adair, said to the soldier, "Why did you change your story?" And he said, "Because the major ordered me to." And everybody heard this. So after the lunch break, well, the screws took me back down to the cell. And the screw said to me, "Did you hear?" I said, "Yeah, I heard it. But, and you have got me on trial." Anyway, and there was a complete change then in the screws to me, yeah. But after the lunch break, when and the judge all on right, then sweeps the judge all sit down, and the judge says, "Now, where was I?" And the prosecutor stands up and says, and this is all in the transcript of my trial, which is on LinkedIn and documents. It's all there. He said, so the prosecutor says to the judge, "Your Honor, could we approach a bench?" And the judge says, "Well, why is that?" And he said, and I'm quoting here, he said, "A situation has occurred which requires myself and my learned friend having some discussion." So he said that first of all. And then he said, "May we approach a bench?" So the judge, the prosecutor and my barrister argued in the middle of the court in whispers. And they're like, "Yes, two heads going." And the stenographer, she's sitting where her fingers above the keyboard. She couldn't type anything because she couldn't hear what was going on. So Mr. Adair said, "Your Honor, may we approach the bench?" "Judge, you may." So they go up, and for 2 minutes, the three of them argued in whispers. No, like all whispering, and they're all animated. No, so they go back to their positions. And the judge says, "Well, this case is over. I have to find that these bullets were planted by person or persons not before this court. This trial is stopped. You are free to go." And so there was uproar, and the soldiers all shouting and you know. So that was it. So went out, everything happy. So I went back to work on the Falls Road, and I kept getting harassed as usual, getting stopped left, right, and centre. So what they were doing then was they were stopping, not searching me, they were stopping me in the taxi, getting everybody out and searching it. Right? Every time got down the road. So all the people got to know me and got to know me and wouldn't get in my taxi. So I ended up having to leave a false road and I went private taxi. So, you know, and then what then after all the rest, you can read the rest in the book because, you know, it's all convoluted. Now, okay. Did you want to ask me any questions on what a parindi? Mm-hmm. Oh, listen, before I go on, honey, there's as I said, no one will report on this. Now, I have accused solicitors and everyone else of being corrupt, and they will not sue me. Now, this solicitor, Norman Shannon, about the docs. And when I was first sacked my docs, I went to this solicitor, and he took the case, and all the letters are on the web. But then nothing happened for years, and I took a case off him and went to this other solicitor, Norman Shannon. His boss, what was it? I can't remember his name. And Shannon was a junior solicitor in the firm. And what happened was, he was a junior solicitor, and he took a case. He was instructed to deal with a case. And what happened? He messed the case up. No, that's not what happened. Yeah, he messed it up already. But he left the solicitors and set up on his own and took my case with him. And he done nothing on it for 7 years. And he kept telling me the other side won't enter the defense and there's nothing I can do. And then after 7 years, he told me, it's statute barred. And I said, what do you mean statute barred? Is that me? He said, well, we can't go to court, statute barred. So I said, but you have had the case for 7 years. And he said, well, but the other side wouldn't have defense. And nothing I could do, and it was statute. So anyway, I cracked up. So he says, look, I'll get you a barrister's opinion. And he got a barrister's opinion. And it's all in the documents.
Yeah, let's maybe begin to wrap it up because there's just so much here. I've got loads of questions, but I think as far as our listeners, they might do well to either read your books or have got so much information on LinkedIn, maybe just share places where folks could get more information. And your books are still available on Amazon, right?
Yes, on Amazon and that other one, what do you call it?
Barnes & Noble.
Yeah,
I saw it there. I don't want to overwhelm folks because there's just so much here, but I do think they need to find out more. And so that might be the better way to digest all of this information. I think you've given us a whole lot of like, oh my gosh, moments that it's clearly not right, not legal. It's not a good situation. Yeah. So yeah, maybe share the places folks can then find out more about you.
Yeah, but this cancel culture.
Yeah.
Now, this is what's being done on me. You know what I mean? No one, I'm not allowed, no one, everyone, all the journalists here, no one will take it. None of these papers will expose it.
Right.
And there's a guy, Hardy Crossgrove, he has got this ditch thing on the web. He's a web entrepreneur. And he...
Somehow we got disconnected, and when I try to redial him back in Dublin, I don't have a dial tone anymore. So I guess I will finish out this interview myself and send everybody over to LinkedIn and look up Hugh Murphy. Just type in the search bar Hugh Murphy. There's much information there that he shares, and also his books titled Memories and Observations and The Judas Goat are both available at Amazon.com. And I thank Hugh for taking the time to share this unbelievable story with us. There's so much more to find out. Please head over to LinkedIn and Amazon. Hugh Murphy, we thank you for caring.